Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Now we are, Jonathan. Now we are.
Now we are here.
Now we are.
Okay. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hey. Good.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Great. Good to see everybody. We got some playoff baseball coming, Brian. Coming
to a city. I don't know if I do, but you do. I think the Cubs are, they've blown it. But I'm excited to root for your Phillies. Bryce Harper last night taking on Angel Hernandez, the worst umpire in all of baseball, and then throwing his helmet into the stands to the adoring Phillies fans. I'm not from Philadelphia. I have no family in Philadelphia, but I root for the Phillies often because they tend to make the playoffs when the Cubs don't. So I will be backing you and your fair city of brotherly love.
That's really nice. That's really nice, Brian. You know what Bryce Harper said before the game last Saturday?
I wish I'd never left the Washington Nationals.
No. He said.
See, it's a sports thing I knew. Come on.
No.
That was good.
He said, go Bucks. So, what do you think about that? What do you think about
McGrupp repping some Osiris pods across the channel here? Great segue from Always Almost There. Go Phillies. Hey, man. I'm into all of this. Happy
Cheers.
Friday. Happy
yeah. Friday afternoon. We're going forward as we often do, except when we go backwards, which is also often. But today we're going forward to 2011, and we are going to get to that show in just a minute after a very quick introduction. How's everybody doing? And also, where are we? Where are we in this series? Where are we in this series?
We're in 2011.
We're almost done, kind of, not really.
2 years into 3.0, I mean, it's kind of wild to think about how we are almost done, mathematically speaking,
but
how much there is still to go. And when you think back to this and you listen back to a show like this and then kind of hop around the year as I do in the week leading up to these episodes, you remember kind of like the feelings that you had at this point during Fish History, especially in early 3.0. Jonathan talked about this last week, that, you know, that kind of understanding we all had for the band as they were trying to rebuild in 2009. And there was this kind of just simple joy around them being back that was wearing off ever so slightly into 2010. And it definitely was wearing off here in 2011. Although we start to hear kind of the building blocks towards what's coming. It's a really interesting period for Phish, but, I will just say as well, I only saw two shows this year. So this was like the, I was living in the Pacific Northwest. Phish rarely comes to the Pacific Northwest. So I webcasted a decent amount. I listened to all these shows, but I wasn't going to see a bunch of these shows. What about you, Meg? Were you back on the train with Phish?
No, I only saw one show this year and I moved abroad this year. So things were changing for me really dramatically, but I only saw the January 1st show. And, you know, I alluded to it last week, but it was the only Phish show that I've actually left early. And it was a good show. It was a great show. But my friends from college came up to see the show. I had a daughter that was about to turn one and I had a two-year-old. And they came up to Brooklyn and we met at like noon. And I was so excited to see them. And these were like my friends in college. You know how you have those friends who like, when you see them, you immediately revert back to like your 19-year-old self that like makes bad decisions and is just like there to have a really good time. That was what happened to me. So when we met up at like 12, we started partying and ended up at Brother Jimmy's, RIP, and drank like pitchers and pitchers of beer. We were like smoking time. I mean, it was not good. And then by the time the second set came, I was way overserved. I was just way overserved. And I was like in the venue and I was trying to like pull it together. My friend like brought me to the bathroom and was like, "Are you going to be okay?" It was like shaking me. I was like, "You're going to make it. Like, just like, you know, get it together." And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it. And everything started to spin and I had to go. I wasn't like, I didn't have my sea legs in me anymore. Like, I didn't know how to do Phish anymore. You know, I wasn't like, I didn't remember how to do it and I wasn't prepared. So it was really lame. That was the only show I saw that year.
And that was still the old garden. That was before all.
Thank God,
the
because
work.
I may have left my mark at a place in that garden, but I'm not going to talk about that. But luckily, it's the old one, so it's all good. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I got to go there in April of that year, and I lament what was. Although it's fine now, sure. But
I mean, it's nicer. It just doesn't have that fun giant concourse, which was the best.
Yes. I only saw one Phish show that year, though. That was and after that show, I checked out. I mean,
yeah,
I didn't check out. I just stopped caring enough to go, and I didn't go see them again until 2013.
What show did you see?
First Night Merriweather.
Okay.
Yeah. One Night of Merriweather.
Mm-hmm. So the last Albuquerque that's ever been played.
Yeah, 7-Eleven. I was like, if I'm not going to play Albuquerque anymore, I don't need to go see him again.
Wow. I didn't realize that was the last one. That's crazy.
Yeah. I knew.
Yeah. I had seen it a few times. I was like, unimpressed. So.
Oh, a little flex there. I see.
I feel like this was a little bit of a quiet period for Phish. Like, it was kind of before them talking a lot about stuff, you know? It was before, like... Mm-hmm. Segments on Phish Radio and more interviews and podcasts and all kind of things. Now we hear from the band all the time now.
Yeah.
Really relative. But
the banter on this show is like the most revealing bit.
Yeah.
They're like right before the encore. I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. I forgot about Trey telling us how encores work for them.
yeah.
Which is relevant to our conversations this year.
But, yeah.
I feel like you guys think sack for the year for the band.
What do you guys think that they were like? What do you guys think that Phish was kind of going through at that time? Like, do you think they were all fully just back, like back in the swing of things for 3.0? Because we don't really know. I don't think there's a lot of documentation about what was going on in 2011 with them.
No, I mean, I think the way I've always taken this year is they came off of a really strong fall tour in 2010. They took about 6 months off. We didn't hear from them until Memorial Day, but the summer was pretty packed with Phish. We had a run up until the end of June. We had, Festival 8 came back, but like nobody knew if that was just an 09 phenomenon that like we're kind of hitting all the beats of what, you know, made Phish special. So it was like a Halloween festival combo. Having a 4th of July festival kind of reset that like festivals may be a regular thing in this period in time. And then they started this new tradition with Labor Day at Dick's. And so, you know, they probably didn't envision at that point in time that this would be 12 years running, 13 years going, but, you know, they inadvertently started a new tradition for themselves. So I say all that because like, I think that they were really trying to hit the summer strong. It's, you know, the whole summer, as I recall, was kind of dominated by Phish being on tour. And you had the Storage Jam, which really showcased the band reaching a little bit deeper improvisationally and musically into communication around what could come next. To that point in time, we hadn't had that much kind of dark and eerie jamming. But then on the flip side, you know, they took the fall off, first year without a fall tour in 3.0. They play this New Year's run that kind of showcased the limits of where we were at that point in time. And I remember walking out of the New Year's run 2011. I didn't go, but remember listening to it and thinking we might have reached the end of 3.0. That is, to my ears, maybe the worst run of Phish since they came back in 2009. It's very uninspired. The set lists are very kind of blasé. The jamming is pretty non-existent. It just ends up being an uninspired run to my ears. And I remember leaving that thinking, this is potentially the end. Like, why would they keep working so hard at something that they're taking one step forward, two steps back? That changes significantly in 2012. But I wonder, you know, Jonathan, for you, you know, you kind of hopped off the ship midway through 2011. Did you feel similar things at that point in time? Like, what were your thoughts on all this?
I want to give you a lot of credit for your comment about how the New Year's run showcased their limitations. That's amazing. I was at the Merriweather show. I was in the pit, went up there with some friends, got in there nice and early. It did not go in the rail. I was in the back of the pit of Merriweather, which is not a very big space. And I was, I didn't have a great time. And I think that's enough. I think that's enough of a reason to decide you don't need to go. I feel like Phish was trying. Like, if you look at that set list, you know, it looks like Phish is trying. I just wasn't hitting it for me. So I was I think they proved that out somewhat later in the year. Sorry, Megan, please.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just saying that Matthew Ross had this comment that said, if you don't practice, you get bad at Phish. And he was talking about me. But I also think that they weren't playing a lot of shows. And at this point in their career, getting back into it, to play 40 shows a year, to take off 6 months, you're just not going to be able to play that the way that you want to play. You know, I think if you take that much time off, you can still hit into those moments. And I think you could see that, like, after they've been on tour for a little bit, like this show we're going to talk about today, or like, you know, the end of Super Bowl, or like Dick's, or like, you know, there's points that they came in and that they really Bethel like had it. And Bethel good, yeah. somehow doesn't make sense, but it was really amazing. But mostly the shows that were good were after they'd been, you know, playing for a little while. And so I think they just felt cold and probably not tapped into it and not, you know, playing together enough, especially after being off for so many years. So it's kind of interesting because I feel like this year is like really, there's not a lot there, only 40 shows altogether. And there's just not a lot of really great shows, but they have some really great moments. And I actually felt like I had quite a few shows that I was trying to decide between when I picked the show.
I'm curious what some of the others were.
Yeah, I mean, the 528 Bethel is amazing. That show is just great top to bottom. The last night of Super Bowl, the Blossom show, the Gorge, Detroit, Sunday Dick's. But I really wanted to do a show after the Storage Jam because I feel like that was really pivotal to this year and also just to early 3.0. So that's why I chose this show. And I think the show, the flow is so great, but I've always especially loved the second set.
It's funny you had the Bethel. I think that the best thing they played at Bethel that year was like 26th.
The Waves
though,
sound
right?
check. Yeah. Yeah. But the show, the 28th, is awesome.
Can we just talk about the Storage Jam real quick? Because I listened to it today for the first time in a really long time. And besides that really cool, like Pink Floyd style jam in the middle, what else is significant about this besides showing that Fish can still make like weird noises for really long periods of time? Which I think is,
I think you nailed it.
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of what it was.
I think it's a functional exercise more than anything. It's them in front of people playing that way. Jonathan just referenced the Bethel Tech Waves, which is, I think, like 27 minutes. They just released on the LP2.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite jams of the entire 3.0, 4.0 era. That is in front of no one. That is, you hear this, like, you know, emotionally, you hear Trey at the start. And as a fan, I say emotionally because, like, when you hear it, you get so excited, even 12 years later, turns to Paige and goes, "Do you want to play a jammier song?" Paige goes, "I do." And you like hear this sensation from the band of like, yes, we want to like feel that we can take this risk again. And this is totally my interpretation. I still think at this point in time, there was a fear of falling on their faces or falling back on habits from 2003, 2004. And the Storage Jam is that time where they don't have to announce it. They can play it in front of a live audience, but it's only people who are really dedicated to search them out. It gets a little chilly at that point in time in, you know, upstate New York. It's late at night. It's been a long day. And they can just fuck around with zero expectations to peak a jam, to reward anyone emotionally. And that to me was, I would argue until the Fuck Your Face show, the most important thing that they did in the first 4 years of 3.0, regardless if musically it sounds, quote, good.
I mean, we've seen this as we've gone through this project and other information that's come to us, you know, which is that Trey in particular, but Fish as a band, they work up and develop sounds and things in sound checks that don't surface in front of an audience sometimes for years.
Yeah.
You know, Trey talked about it when he was in one of his rig rundowns where he's like, yeah, just, you know, come out here and I make these loops and sounds and stuff to get warmed up. And then, you know, turns out he's been doing that for a while and it just starts to come out on stage. I think that Bethel Waves is an example of that. And this is the thing.
Even like, going back, the Clifford Ball soundcheck jam sounds like 97, 14 months early. Sorry to interrupt
you.
Like,
no, you're doing spot this on. It's a perfect example. And I think that goes to kind of what Megan was saying, which is that there are high points in this year. They just weren't committing to doing it with a frequency that was, I felt, satisfying. Other people were having a great time. And that was another part of it. It was like me stepping away. It was because other people are having a great time. They don't need me standing there like this with my arms crossed, you know, beside them, because I'm not. So I went home. I kept listening. I listened to every single show during that time when I wasn't seeing them because I was looking for it. And I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty good here and there, you know, but it wasn't getting me out of the house. And eventually did.
RJ, what were your thoughts on this year? Were you seeing a lot of shows? You obviously are 2 years away from starting a podcast at this point in time. Are you even like conceiving of figuring out a way to talk about Fish in this sort of manner? Like, where are you at with Fish?
No, not really. I mean, I saw the two Meriwether shows and then the first, you know, at MSG, like I told that story at the end of last week. And then I saw the 29th. So two MSG shows and two Meriwether shows. Yeah, I was just going, like, having fun. I mean, it was fine. You know, I think it was mostly just going and having fun. I didn't actually think about starting the podcast until my wife was pregnant with our first kid, which was apparently a good time to start a
perfect
new
time.
Big project.
It's always a good time.
Think you'll ever finish that project?
No. Still on your way. Yeah. Still happening.
I just want to say... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't think it... I don't think... I'm not even sure that I listened to like a lot of these shows until later, you know,
Like going back and catching up just because of projects for the podcast and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing I do think is notable, because Megan, you did say, and Jonathan, you echoed this, like there were highs during a year that had, I don't want to say necessarily lows. It just, a lot of the year felt kind of just like plateauing at times. And then there'd be these big spike moments. But I was at the Gorge, And the rock and roll that was played that show is still one of the most exciting gems I've ever seen, still one of the most exciting gems I've ever heard. And that is them plucking out elements of the storage jam and plopping it into another, you know, another jam vehicle and testing the waters there. You heard it in that rock and roll. You heard it in the light from Tahoe. You hear it scattered throughout this show. You hear it in the Down with Disease the following night. You hear it in the Piper from 9-4. And then I forget which, I think it's the light from the New Year's Eve show. But you heard these elements of this experimental set piece dispersed throughout the
storage jamming.
Storage jamming, yes, was what we called it at the time. And it definitely showcased a new style for the band. I don't think it's necessarily carried over. Parts of it have. When they get dark, when they get weird, when they get industrial, you think about like the Deer Creek Simple from 2021. There are moments where it's here, but it always has seemed to me as a functional inspiration and a functional tool for them to just move beyond whatever it was that they were doing. And we wouldn't necessarily see that come to fruition for another 15 months.
I also really like the indie rock influences that Trey's playing with during some of the jamming in this. Like, I think it's really cool. Like, reading about that he was listening to a lot of Beach House and trying to like use that and style of playing and like really sparse and the way that he was plucking his instrument. Like, that's really cool. And I love knowing what Trey was listening to and listening to something as diverse as that while he was thinking about his jams. Like, so cool. That's one of the reasons why I chose this show too.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station. It was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like the Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com/VIP/helpingfriendly. That's DistroKid with a capital K, .com/VIP/helpingfriendly for a special offer. Thanks, DistroKid.
Do we want to get into some of the usual formal aspects of our episode here with like...
Very formal.
Cultural and... We've basically been in Meg's corner without letting Meg run it. Which should we do first?
God damn it. That's okay. It's all right.
Is there anything that we missed, Meg, from your corner? Or should we jump into pop culture?
We can just go really quickly. The only things I want to say are that last year I neglected to mention that Trey got a new guitar in 2010. And I felt like I should have mentioned that. So the Ossodoc introduced like almost a year exactly before this show. As I mentioned, they did 40 shows this year. We talked a lot. Brian, you kind of went through their tour schedule, so I'm not going to go through that again. For the releases this year, we have Live Bait 4, 5, and 6. They're going to release the Hampton Winston-Salem 97 CD box set, which I fucking love. No surprise there, but my brother-in-law got this for me, and I was so happy about it. And I love this CD box set.
It's one of the last things I bought on CD.
Really? Yeah. It's like one of the, like, just so good. I'm going to spin that again soon. And then there's Live Fish releases. The archive releases are the Live Fish Japan release. So they're going to release that 99 Fuji Rock show. They're going to release 12/31/91 from Worcester. And then Trey has an album that's like a six-pack tab sampler from his winter 2011 tour. And then there are only 10 debuts this year. Only one original song, which also probably speaks to why this year is kind of lame. And that song, of course, is Steam. And that's it. That's all I got.
And that's never was heard from again, right?
Yeah, wait. Right. wait, it's everywhere.
Steve's a banger. We like that one.
New Year's.
So 2011, we basically have 3 months of Phish, and the rest of the year is to consume pop culture, which we did, all of us, every single one. Television, this is, I was looking back through the year. This is kind of the shift that I've been talking about as we've been leading up to this, where we have shows like The Sopranos, Mad Men, The Wire, Breaking Bad, starting to take over kind of prestige TV. This is where like streaming starts to become the next kind of step forward, like where we're at currently with television kind of starts around 2011. Game of Thrones debuts this year, one of the biggest shows in television history. Derided now, but the series Louie was in its second or third season at this point in time, and this was kind of like peak comedy on television. Homeland season one, speaking of streaming, this show kicked off great first season. Breaking Bad was in season four. Downton Abbey, for those of us who like British period melodramas, debuted season one. Yes, please. Portlandia debuted, which just existed to annoy me because I lived in Portland and it was so accurate. It was like I was just watching my life on television. And Enlightened, a great show on HBO, had season one. If you guys haven't seen that, Laura Dern, amazing stuff. Midlife Crisis, Laura Dern. Excellent, excellent show. Movies. This is, I was going back through the last few years. This is like the weakest year in movies that we've had in probably a decade. But there were some good ones. It's kind of like Phish. Limitless with Bradley Cooper. Bridesmaids, huge, hilarious movie.
Oh, that's funny.
Midnight in Paris with Owen Wilson. The Tree of Life with Brad Pitt. Contagion, a movie that was filmed in my hometown about a pandemic that I watched for the first time on, I think, like March 11th. 2020, and I was like, oh shit, this is what we're about to deal with. it like felt like a documentary at the time, but I was like, at the end of it, when like they go back to normal, I was like, when the hell is that gonna happen? Drive, another great movie to showcase how incredible Ryan Gosling is. Moneyball, probably my favorite movie of the year. Brad Pitt as Billy Bean. Margin Call, J. Edgar, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. The Descendants, starring George Clooney. Mm. Another Alexander Payne film, one of my favorites. The Best Picture winner that year. Does anyone recall what won the Best Picture in 2011?
No.
No idea.
The Artist. You have any idea what movie won the Best Picture in 2011? Has anybody seen this movie? I've seen it once. It's not very good. I don't recommend it. Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, great Gary Oldman movie. Extremely loud and incredibly close. A 10 years on from 9/11 movie. Music. The number one song in America at the time of this show. Does anyone have any idea? This is, I said last week it was one of the worst songs ever. This is probably the worst song in history. Meg, do you have any idea? Wow. August 2011.
No, but the worst song in history. I don't know. What is it?
Party Rock Anthem by L.
That really is so bad. Oh my God.
Thank you for not defending that. I was worried there we were going to get a Meg defense on that.
No. Oh my God. Come on, Brian.
I'm sorry. I still don't know what it is.
Well,
you don't want to.
Kind of glad to.
Everybody's a party rock. My sister-in-law had her bachelorette party in Las Vegas like the next year, and I had to go from London to Las Vegas for this bachelorette party, which is a hilarious story because I missed my flight home, which is like, I still haven't lived that down. But while I was there, that song was like playing in the clubs in Vegas, and it was a tragedy.
We went to a wedding in summer of 2011 and my wife was in it, and she had to come out with the entire wedding party to that song, and she still hates every aspect of that memory. Some killer records though this year. 2011 was a great year for albums. Just running through a few of them. PJ Harvey's Let England Shake, St. Vincent's Strange Mercy, Bon Iver's self-titled album, my favorite Bon Iver record and my favorite record of that year. Toon Yards, Who Kill, Destroyers, Kaput, Shabazz Palace's Black Up, Danny Brown's Triple X, Tim Hecker's Rave Death 1972, Fleet Foxes, Helplessness Blues, Nicholas Jarre's Space is Only Noise, Lowe's Come On, Wilco's The Whole Love, Kendrick Lamar's Section 80, first record from Kendrick Lamar, Juliana Barwick's The Magic Place, Girls, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Bill Callahan's Apocalypse, The War on Drugs, Slave Ambient, Kurt Vile's Smoke Ring for My Halo.
Love that.
Radiohead's The King of Limbs, Cosmo Combs' Wit's End, and The Weeknd, House of Balloons. There are many others that I am skipping over here. I know it's not a completist list, but great, great year in music. Some of those are just foundational records for me. So a lot of those are records I go back to on a regular basis. Anybody have anything else that they want to add to the music list?
I would just like to say that once again, I was duped and I went to the final LCD Sound System concert that year.
Oh, you were at that.
I mentioned it earlier. That is, you know, part of my ongoing lawsuit against them and Ozzy Osbourne for the No More Tours tour and a few others. But it was awesome.
It's a great show.
Yeah, yeah, they put on an amazing show.
Yeah, and that one's just long and cool. Dance heavy, and yeah, the DVD's great.
So, can we talk about this indoor fish show during the summer? What do you guys think about this? What do you guys think about this summer indoor concert experience?
I like the Baker's Dozen.
Fish. Yeah,
I'm
indoor
into
fish
it.
Is fun. It's very nice to not worry about weather, you know, especially like after spending like, you know, a hurricane style thing in Wilmington this year to be like, okay, well, I'm going to MSG and I don't have to stress. Like, it's all going to be good. It's nice. And this was so like 9,000 people. It's pretty small, right?
And if you keep your eyes open as well. when the lights and look at the lights, then the lights are full blast, you know, at the beginning of the show,
mm-hmm.
which you don't get in the summer for sets. I never look at them, but you know, other people really like that sort of thing.
I feel like when I used to do a lot of Dead tour and like fish tour in the summer, when I was younger, that would be like such a relief when you'd finally get to like Detroit and you'd be like, great, I get to be inside. I don't have to like be in like, you know, 1,000 degrees in this place or like a storm in Deer Creek or like, it's going to be great. It's just kind of like it releases the pressure valve a little.
I mean, I think to your question, RJ, like, the feeling of being outdoors at a fish show in the summertime, the breeze, the way the sound kind of drifts out of an amphitheater, that does hearken to like some really nice memories. But it is cool and it is unique that I remember when this run was announced, there was a ton of excitement around it because they had not played UIC since 98, I want to say. And so it's an old venue.
Wow.
There's no curfew. It's not GA, but it just, from what I recall, and I went to a few shows here growing up in the Chicago suburbs, it just has like a freedom of movement. There's pretty lax security. So it kind of feels, I think for a lot of fans, it felt like a throwback of sorts, almost like what we were talking about last week with Utica, Augusta, Maine, you know, these small mm-hmm. Northeast industrial cities. This kind of felt like a throwback as well.
It's interesting, though, the two previous years they had played Toyota Park. So mm-hmm. I think people had probably begun to expect that. And perhaps that was part of the prototyping for Dix, you know, playing the mm-hmm. soccer stadium situation. I imagine people, I can't remember. So I'm going to just imagine that people were a little surprised at this announcement. There was a guarantee. There was somebody who said, well, what about that amphitheater or whatever, World Tinley Park? And somebody surely mm. responded, well, that place is an old dump. But
I also seem to recall that this was a year that Alpine was hosting less concerts and was kind of mm. hosting just like
kind of like every
four
year
shows. Yeah, I mean, this was like around the time that they started to really downscale the amount of shows that were there. Pearl Jam 20 was at Alpine, but I think that was one of the only major events. I'm just remembering this, so I apologize. I don't want to toss us back to Meg's Corner, but I think it is relevant. You know, we're talking about indoor-outdoor fish. We're talking about traditions, where the band was at. They announced that they were playing Dick's Sporting Goods Park over Labor Day. If you look through fish history, there's not a lot of shows over Labor Day going back to the inception of the band. This was not like a highlight period the way New Year's Eve or Halloween or Thanksgiving is for fish. But I remember a video appearing online after the announcement that drives you down I-270 past all the oil refineries in Commerce City with like some fish jam playing it. It just said, "Welcome to beautiful Commerce City." And I say all that because like there was kind of a, what the fuck, why are they playing outside of Denver, Colorado over Labor Day? Like there was a ton of skepticism around that run. And it wasn't until the end of that weekend that everyone was like, "You better come back here next year. This has got to happen again."
Yeah. The skepticism, I think, was legit. But, you know, I think part of the reason they weren't playing Labor Day before, like it was Labor Day is when all the schools are getting back in swing. You know, Fish was in the early 90s, you know, playing colleges. And that was not when colleges were booking bands. And that's, you know, so it was always a little like down moment. And summer's over, fall hasn't kicked in. And then they'd come back. So it was an interesting move. And I think when they first started, I was like, well, shit, I can't go to this because my kids always start school right after that. Now my kids are old and they don't care where I am. So it's easier. But,
yeah, I mean, they started like this amazing tradition. You know, it's like mm-hmm. they knew that this was going to be a special place and it just became such a huge special place. I mean, it's incredible to think it's been going on for that long.
Whoever brought that idea to the band, I'm sure they're well appreciated.
Quite.
Seriously. Okay, Megan, what do we say about the show before we talk about it?
I mean, I think we kind of set it up. I think that, you know, the flow is amazing and I'm really excited to talk about it. I think we should just get into it.
Let's do it. You want to read us set one?
Let's do it. So set one is Back on the Train, Into Rift, Into Gula Papyrus, Scent of a Mule, Jesus Just Left Chicago, Wolfman's Brother, Anything But Me, Babylon Baby, Reba, Alumni Blues, Into Letter to Jimmy Page, Into Alumni Blues. So excited to talk about Babylon Baby.
Well, there's a lot of rarities in this. There's a lot of rarities in this set. It's really interesting. A lot of like strange placements. Like you get started off immediately. Back on the Train has only opened a show four times. 7-7-2000, 3-7-09, 8-15-11, and 7-29-03. This is only one of 10 Jesus Just Left Chicago's in 3.0. It has not been played since 12-3-2019. This was the last Anything But Me, and this is one of three Babylon Babies. And then obviously Alumni Blues, Jimmy Page, Alumni Blues, very rare, special song whenever it's played. I say all that just because like at a time when there's not a lot of new songs being debuted, at a time when there's some stale aspects to the set listing, this was a show that immediately when the set list started to unfold and when you got the tape or you saw the show come up on Live Fish, it just looks exciting. It may look a little tame right now, the first set, but it really looked exciting at the time. And that's really important because this was a back to front, like first and second set were just jam packed for the era.
I looked at this to listen to it. And I remember, you know, the thing about the second set, but I looked at this first set and I was like, do I need to listen to this? And I did. And it was, I think the word I would use to describe it is fine. I think, Megan, we talked about this before everybody else was on. It's like Jesus Just Left Chicago is a jam chart version. And Paige goes off on this version, excuse me. That's a weird sentence. He does kind of rip, but it's not a jam. It's a solo. So it may be an exceptional performance. The Wolfman's also is a jam chart. And I think it's...
gets to a pretty unique space, especially for the time.
I mean, it's good it's like for type the
time,
one.
In particular for the time. But is it like...
It's not like recent versions
that have really, if you didn't
no, it's not like recent versions, but like in the moment this was, and this kind of gets to what we were talking about last week.
Peaks nicely, actually. but
yeah, like they are at a point where they are experimenting ever so slightly. Like these are not long jams. They're not long diversions. You were looking at this point in time and you were getting really excited for like 90 seconds of weirdness.
Yeah. I mean, I think this show has a lot of energy, like right out the gate, like Back on the Train has like a pretty good peak. Like they just sound energized. Rift is super high energy. Pace is really fast. There's like a fun little playing around at the beginning of Gula. Like it has a lot of energy. There's so much like just heart and emotion in Jesus Just Left Chicago. Like I don't like when Fish plays the blues, but this song is okay just because I love Paige. And like just hearing him like throw down on the organ is like, it's awesome. And this Wolfman's is great, especially like you're saying, Brian, for the time. Like they come out of the funk jam. It stays like within like a type one space, but it has like a monster ending, like a really powerful peak. It's really perfect at this point in the set. And I think Anything But Me sounds great in this spot. It's such a pretty song. I love the lyrics of this song. I really would like this song to come back into rotation. Mm-hmm. Babylon Baby just... yeah, it happened. They played it once in like 2011, once in 12, and once in 13, and that's fine. And then just a nice Reba and like a fun, powerful, like, you know, alumni blues section to end the set. So I think this is fun. I bet in the room at the moment, this was felt really great.
I like the
It research. Is really funny to me that Babylon Baby sounds like everything we talked about modern Mike songs. And like I had forgotten what this song sounded like, and it immediately starts and it's like this fun little boppy thing, and then it like goes into this weird little prog place, and then it goes to another place, and then to another place, and then Mike's singing about like, I don't know, the whole time I was listening I was like, this could have been written in 2021, like weird.
Yeah.
This is just a Mike song.
It's kind of impressive how he can do that.
I think the
it's amazing.
The set closer is great, and the noise that the crowd's making at the end of the set is just awesome. It's really pretty impressive and notable. I think that everyone was just super, alumni, super high energy.
Brian's spot on. Alumni was rare. They had played it in 99, they played it twice in 2010. And nobody thought we'd get it in 2010, and nobody had any reason to think that it would come back in 2011 right here.
Right.
So I think the enthusiasm is justified.
Yeah, and Trey says right when he's starting the riff, that big green ball came up here just enough times. I remember my brother texting me at set break. He was at this show, and there was just this giant ball floating amongst the crowd that just said Alumni Blues, and it just kept going to the stage. And it was one of those moments that, like, Trey is, you know, you were looking for this stuff at this time. It kind of reminds you of his speech or his story during Colonel Forbin's at Super Bowl, where he talks about how the entire Fish experience has been an illusion and has been, you know, them projecting their life and their music from a storage van. You know, it was this sort of kind of wink humor, like being brought into the joke, that was not prevalent at all in 2.0. And when it happened repeatedly, it made up for lack of jamming. It made up for lack of debuts. It just made you feel, you know, it had an old school feel to it from a Fish standpoint. So that was a great way to end this overall set. But to your point, it's a first set. And if this first set was played now, I don't think it would have as, you know, warm of a reception as it had in 2011. But in 2011, this felt like one of the strongest sets of the year.
I mean, you both said it at one point each, you Brian and Megan, that this is good for the year. This jam is good for 2011. But looking at, you know, from a broader lens, it's fine.
So, Megan, the second set, how long do you think this idea was planned for? Did it just like happen that day?
I don't know. Probably set break. I don't know. Maybe sound check. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. I don't really know.
Days before. I almost get the sense like that this was something that, because they kind of use this, maybe not intentionally, but like as a tester of what's going to happen 2 weeks later at Dick's, where they play an entire show featuring songs that start with the letter S, which a year later is going to lead to Fuck Your Face. Like,
yeah,
it almost seems like hey, we've got this song Steam and we've got all these other songs, you know, maybe something that like, you know, someone behind, someone backstage in their orbit brought to them. It was like, hey, you have all these songs that kind of align subject matter wise. And it leads to this sort of setlist construction that kind of breaks the mold as the band's going forward. But I have no idea either.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe somebody mentioned it and it's been percolating in the back of somebody's brain for a short time prior, but I would imagine it's like at set break or that afternoon, Trey's like, hey, you know, all these songs are on the table right now because, you know, we haven't played for a couple nights and it was out west and whatever, whatever. Let's string them together in this way. They definitely had the plan coming out on stage. It wasn't made up on the spot.
No way.
Because they played through it and then they left and then they had plenty of time for the encore.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, I feel like it's, I think the shorter time frame, but it was awesome. It worked great.
Yeah. And I like that idea of them like playing around with the theme and how that's going to like influence. I mean, they go really full into that in 3.0, you know? So it's cool to think about it starting kind of at this point.
But tell us what the second set is, Meg, and what the theme is. There's people out there who probably have never heard this.
Okay. So the set list is sand into light, into dirt, into waves, into undermine, into steam, into fire. It's the elements, baby.
I love that element of undermine.
Yeah. And the encore is camel walk, Gayudi, the horse, into silent in the morning, Harry Hood. I mean, that must have seemed crazy at the time, but we'll get there.
Yes.
So is light is light fire? I mean, light's not an element.
No.
I think it's loosely defined.
I guarantee if somebody wants to dig up my message board posts from the era, I probably argued against the notion that it was elements, but I gave up because everybody called it that. And I was like, okay, whatever. I mean,
it's one of those things that once someone called it, it stuck and it just wasn't, even though it wasn't 100% accurate.
Right.
I mean, if they did the element set now, we'd get Soul Planet, you know, because that's Earth. Earth is an element.
Earth. Yeah.
Okay. Well, either way, I think there's some, undermine is great. Great element. There's a lot of good elements. Maybe it's more of a periodic table kind of approach with made up stuff.
Oh, then we could get Mercury.
Made up stuff. But it doesn't exist.
Came to play, goes, this is why fish fans can't have nice things, which I'm guessing is, hey, you just accept it. It's a good thing. No,
exactly.
No, we have to break it apart. No, I mean, I think ultimately, like, regardless if it all works from a, you know,
I did say it was cool.
Thematic standpoint, it's very cool and it offers them this chance where pretty much all of these songs expand a little bit.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, like a song like Sand that had some really great moments in early 3.0 is kind of working its way towards that brilliant version at Dick's. You're seeing them break out of Sand, a song that even when it was played for 17 minutes in the late 90s was Mike and Fish holding on a very similar beat. They're starting to experiment with that. Light is a song that has been probably the most freeing experimental song of the era. And then Waves and Undermine, you know, these two songs that are, Waves has had huge moments earlier in the year. Undermine has some pretty big jams ahead of it. Like, these are songs that are starting to kind of plant a flag as, you know, jamming vehicles for the 3.0 period, where either they were brand new songs like Undermine or Waves that had a few moments in 2.0, but hadn't really been a jam vehicle since then.
Yeah, I love
this. What do you guys think about the flow of this?
I mean, I think this is like perfect flow and obviously something that was planned, but it sounds very natural. And I think it has just like a really nice ebb and a flow to it. Like, with Sand comes in, everybody just sounds super locked in right away. Paige is on the piano. There's like beautiful interplay between Paige and Trey. And then you've got like the whale calls kind of segueing to end it, but it actually works. It's not like overkill yet. And I love how they segue into Light, which quickly kind of goes right off the rails, really textured, ends like in like a light plinko, but they don't kind of like get stuck there. I think that like when I was listening back to this, I felt they weren't kind of just grasping onto things and holding on to it. They were kind of really, they sounded really like open and free in a way that I hadn't heard a lot of in early 3.0. This end of Light is really pretty, super vibey. Trey's playing those like descending notes and Paige's on the organ. And then Landing in Dirt is, to me, the most perfect call. This song is, I think, one of the saddest and most beautiful songs that Phish has ever written. It reminds me of someone that was really special to me. There was like a time in my life when I could not hear this song without crying. And it sounds so nice after a song like Light that is just so kind of like optimistic in its kind of essence, to have a song this sad right after it is just, I think, really beautiful. And Waves is just, I love 2011 Waves. Like, they're all just like great. Like, they all just have such a build to them that feels really natural. And it's got this like, there's this quiet stillness that they find in Dirt. And then they come out just super like building this beautiful, powerful jam in Waves. And Mike sounds incredible, really sick bass line. Trey's like dancing on top. You've got Fishman doing the big drums. And just the flow into Undermine is just so incredible. And like when Trey sings the first lyrics of Undermines, like you were saying, RJ, like the crowd goes insane because you can like hear it coming and the crowd just sounds so happy. It's just, it's awesome. And before I get into Undermine, because that jam's amazing, I want to hear what you guys thought about the beginning of the set.
I mean, I think the sand and the light, what it reminded me is that like it's kind of like a breadth and a willingness to continue like pushing the envelope. And also reminds me that like jams in 2023 are pretty fucking crazy compared to 2011.
Totally. You know? Yeah. We're like, spoiled.
Totally puts like, into perspective how good.
Like people are like, yeah, Phish is so boring now. They're done. They're like, it's crazy. Cause these, no. I mean, it's great, but I mean, compared to what we hear now, it's pretty different. I think to me, the Waves is kind of what makes this set work. In a way, mm-hmm. like those little runs that Trey's doing at the beginning are just amazing. Really awesome. And it just, the transition into Undermine is really, really pretty, pretty amazing. It's great. The flow is great. It's a really, really perfect set.
The energy in Waves is so high coming off of Dirt, which is just beautiful and delicate and perfect. That's the segment. And that I think I most love, but you know, that whole flow through the end, the second half of the set is just so like energy powerful.
Yeah.
As opposed to the emotional power of like Dirt, the energy that they put into the remainder of the set is just super high. And I really enjoyed going back and listening to it multiple times this week.
The, segue into Undermine that you guys have been talking about, this, you know, I said this a bunch last week on the episode. The same applies here. This did not happen really at this point in time. There were a lot of energized buildups and then a fade into a new song. There were some segues during this period, but like something that was, and the incredible Perp, one of our favorite listeners, mentioned this. I'd never heard the show. Undermine was my highlight at the, and the hints at it several minutes before it starts proper. You really hear them like flirting with it, as you guys have been saying. They're not jumping into it. They're in absolutely no rush at this point in time. And they get into it and it almost feels like they're playing a jam off of Undermine and then, okay, we'll sing you the verse just to get it in. They're not trying to play Undermine straight here. But the back end of Undermine is really, I mean, that is the highlight for me for this overall show. And it made me think about like, you know, Trey is such a fascinating guitarist and he's my favorite guitarist I've ever heard. And like, what are my favorite things about him? And it almost is encapsulated at the end of this Undermine. It's not like the speed he plays with. It's not the fact that he can peak, that he can like play around with these effects in such an interesting way. It's when on the fly, he finds a riff that sounds as though it was composed over hours, that someone was like searching for these notes and for this phrasing and for the tempo and the way he just put it out there, and he just does it. And it happens, you know, throughout the entirety of Phish's career. But at this point in time, it was one of the things that was happening very rarely. And you hear it at the end of this. It's not very long. It's not fast. It's just this like rising and then descending melody that sounds, you talk about the sadness of a song like Dirt, like what he's playing here sounds that sad and that beautiful. And it's the kind of thing that just did not happen. And for someone like myself, like listening to this now in the context, like Jonathan, you talked about, and RJ, you talked about like how crazy jams are in 2023 and how nightly we get 10 minutes longer than this Undermined is, and, you know, 50 times as many segments, it feels like, where the band is just jumping from idea to idea to idea in constant conversation, to go back to 2011 and to hear this band figure this sort of stuff out in the moment was probably the reason why I kept listening to them at this point in time, even if, you know, locationally I couldn't see a lot of shows, why I was still like on message boards talking about them and really thinking about this band, because you were hearing these little blips of, okay, they still have it in them. We just got to hear them put it together in a way that, you know, lasts for an entire show or lasts for an entire tour. But all of that is kind of like reduced to 90 seconds here in this Undermined. And it's just, it's amazing to go back and re-listen to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the band interplay too, like everyone is super, super engaged during this Undermine. Like Mike is playing some unbelievable, like repetitive licks in the beginning of this jam. It's super dancey. And then Trey is, yeah, just playing so delicately. Paige is playing so softly. And I love when it gets really quiet. I think when a jam gets really quiet and like you're saying, RJ, you can hear the breath in it. That is, it's so hard to get there. I can't imagine as a band what it takes to slow down and allow things to get to an almost stopping point. It's really, it takes a lot of confidence, and it's beautiful when it works out. And I think you can hear that in this, and it's just, it's so delicate and absolutely love it. And then to play Fire after that and just come out with this like wild energy. That's just, that song is such a throwback, and you know, a song that I used to hear in the 90s, and like, just to hear them like, just absolutely destroy it is just, it's so exciting. And it's funny because at the end of this, I was listening and like, I didn't remember anything about this whole curfew thing. And you can just hear, they sound so loose when they're talking about it. Like Trey's like, you know, usually they tell us that we have a curfew and we have to end, but they didn't tell us. So if you're bored, you can leave, but we're not, you know, it's just like, so like, we're not bored. And then you hear them like, talking about how they can't decide what they're going to play. He's like, we can't decide.
You can hear little hints of this.
Yeah.
Trey hints at Camel Walk. And then it's like, we can't decide.
We can't decide. It's so cute. Yeah. Did they just sound like they're having so much fun, and to play an encore, which is almost like this, what we had this summer, kind of like these like really like intense encores with like four songs that are just like wild. And this is just crazy. Like Camel Walk into Gaiuti. Like this is just crazy. And then to play Horse Silent, which is such a special, like anytime you hear that at a show, you're lucky, because that is just one of the most beautiful things that Phish plays. And then to end with Hood is like, of course they did. And it's, this is great. It's so fun. It's so exciting. And they sound super inspired.
How many times have you heard just like a standalone Harry Hood encore, but like after 25 minutes to then get Harry Hood? And 2011 has a lot of really good Harry Hoods. Trey's playing, especially, as we get to like the Dicks run, his tone and his speed are like, they're just, it's locked in. He sounds great on, you know, these older Phish songs that, you know, just require him to play almost straightforward. And this Hood is just beautiful. It's just, it's really, really gorgeous stuff.
So someone asked earlier about Trey's tone in 2011 when we started. I think it's pretty awesome. I think
it's really good.
Yeah, me too. It's beautiful.
I think a lot of it is the Ossadoc that he got in August 2010 that he's really just, you know, figured out. Someone else asked a question I wanted to throw to you, but RJ, what were your thoughts on the tone? Are you into it?
Just really, really, it's like kind of gnarly. It's awesome. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. I really like it. I heard it more in like the 528 show and some of the other shows that I listened to from this year, but yeah, I'm into it. I think it's great. And can I just share, I was looking at Phish.net reviews of this show, and I'm just going to share this comment from Wax Banks. I'm just going to put it in the chat, but also I can read it. If this isn't the best show of 2011, I'm a monkey's uncle, which wouldn't be so bad, really. Monkeys are lovely creatures, and many of them are good with tools.
Perfect. Nailed it.
Wax Banks is a real treasure.
The best.
We've had him on the show in the way back a couple of times. God,
we need to do it again.
Just the best. I want to share a comment or a question here from a friend of the pod, Cinnamon. When defining it, because this kind of gets to what we were talking about like this show in the context of 2011 versus listening to it 12 years later. When defining a great Phish show, what factors carry the most weight for you guys? Set list, venue vibe, crazy jams, substances ingested, people you are at a show with. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on this and how this show fits into that, because this is considered by a lot of people. It has a 4.55 rating on Phish.net. This is considered a great show. Jonathan, you raised your hand. What is it for you?
The answer is yes. It's any combination of these things could make it that, but great show is entirely subjective. So my great show may not be your great show and vice versa. I just got to remember not to tell you that your great show is terrible and vice versa. Terrible. Meg, what about answer. You? Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I think about in two ways. I think about the shows that I'm at, and most of them are always great for me. And then I think about the shows that I want to talk about on the pod and like digest and analyze. And that's a different thing. That's something that has like, you know, re-listenability, and a show that has like great flow and incredible jams or an interesting set list or historical importance. So there's like things I think about these shows in two different ways, because when I'm at a show, it's totally about who I'm with and you know, the night I'm having and what happened that day and what I've been looking forward to and mostly just who I'm with, though. And because I'm always having fun at a Phish show, but I love it when I get to be with the people that I love. And so to me, it's a totally different experience when I'm thinking about like the shows that I want to talk about for this series. It's been a totally different thing. I've been really trying to think about shows that I didn't either spend a lot of time with, or shows that weren't released by Live Phish, or shows that maybe were really indicative of the year, but that haven't been talked about as much. It's a little bit harder in a year like this, because I think there's just not as many to choose from. But I think that's what's been kind of like one of the most exciting things about this series for me, is just been seeing the shows that everybody picks and kind of like really going deep in some shows that I hadn't done before.
RJ?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, I guess, you know, shows attended and shows listened to are different. I mean, I do think I mostly look at the jams, you know?
Jams.
Like, I don't really care about like bust outs. I don't really care that much about like set lists. I mean, I just like long jams, because I do think that they generally indicate a willingness or ability or something happened that push them in a specific direction. I do like the thematic aspect of the show, just because it's like shows us some forethought. But yeah, I'm kind of here for the jams, guys.
That's fair. I mean, I think
that's too bad. We're doing
here for the jams, man.
When I think about this question, like I don't know. I guess I think about just like shows in general versus shows I've been to, because those are two completely different things in a lot of cases. I think what's interesting about this show is it has that just like that flow factor where it almost doesn't matter the songs that were played. You know, the cool part of the cool thing about it is in part that there's a lot of rare songs that are played that didn't get a lot of, you know, play before or even after. So you're hearing a lot of stuff in a period in time where they wouldn't be repeated. But the second set, beyond the theme of it, it just flows from sand through fire. You press play and there's no reason to skip to another song. There's no kind of abandoned ideas. It's just the band is just like cruising along and kind of feeling. Trey talks often about how he's a conduit, you know, for music. And at their best, there's almost an effortlessness. And this show, compared to a lot this year, like it would have been fascinating to pick a show from this year that wasn't really loved, because I think we could have like nitpicked some really interesting things, but this shows the contrast of that. And this shows kind of the hope of where the band was going within a year that didn't have a ton of those examples. And it's just, the band almost doesn't, it sounds effortless. And that to me is like it's a very subjective thing, but it also like, you know, it seems to be something that is recognized by a lot of the fan base when it happens, that like that set, just really, really good stuff right there. And this show has it. Cause I think, to your point, RJ, I don't really care about set lists. Like, you could play all new songs, and if they are, you know, paired together really nicely through jams, through segues, much like this set is, I'm going to want to listen to it as much as I would a set that has, you know, five of the big Phish songs of all time.
Or you could just want 12/30/19 tweezer every show, which I fully support.
I think it's too much to ask for. But good luck.
It's a little bit greedy, but you know, I support it.
Yeah, me too.
High bar for the band is Meg's nickname.
Yeah, that's me. I'm just always demanding so much when I go to these shows.
Came to play, of course. How would you feel about Big Boat Live?
Oh yeah,
I would like.
There are limits.
If
there
it's
are
played
lines
well, if there are good kids. Segues, we're there for it.
Hey, I always thought Friends jam. Could be
friends to happen. Yeah, yeah.
I always thought Friends could be a great jam vehicle. I always wanted it totally. This way. Home has a jam built into it. What is the acoustic song from 2.0? It's not Running on Empty. That's Jackson Browne. It's
Running Out of Time.
Please help me out here. Running Out of Time. That's a beautiful song. Like
just
midway
like
through
this
the
podcast.
Yeah, we just hit 1 hour, which means that's when we start getting.
Oh yeah.
Getting charged for extra minutes, probably.
Yep.
No, that's not true. But we are going to bring you all back here for 2012, which does turn the tide.
I'm not sure it happened.
It does turn the tide of 3.0, I think.
Yeah, and true? You know what? I've got to make an announcement before that 2012 episode. Something really exciting is going to happen. Do you know what it is? Well, the next time I see you, Brian, it's going to be in real life.
Wow. It's going to be in real life. Mm-hmm. On the rocks.
Yeah. That's guys, crazy. We've been podcasting together for 2 years, and we're finally going
to
meet in person.
See the torchbearers.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Exactly.
That is crazy on the rocks.
You're going to see Billy Strings?
Yeah, that's what it is. Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. So that's an interesting wrinkle in our schedule for next week, but we'll figure that out next week. So thank you guys for tuning in and for hanging out with us.
Can I share something else that happens next week before you press the button, or have you pressed it?
Nope,
next week
it
on the 6th. My new album, which I'll hold far enough back that anybody watching can see, it's called, what's over here, called So Below. Will be out. You can get it on Bandcamp, jmhart.bandcamp.com. You'll probably be able to hear it on streaming services, but you should buy your own copy, of course, because they're cooler that way. CDs look really cool too. They have pictures inside too. Anyways, get yours. You can pre-order it now. You can buy it next week. And thank you guys for your time.
Thank you guys.
Awesome, Jonathan.
Congrats, Jonathan.
Thanks, y'all.
All right. Everybody. We will see you all next week. Thank you.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX, and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.